Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bonjour, good morning. I am delighted to be speaking with you today in the last final lecture of this series. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be able to speak to you with you these last four lectures. And what I'd like to do today for our final lecture is to really put together where we've been and to recast some of what we've heard and to think about general principles in terms of the origin of the great anatomical inventions that we see in the history of life. Life has been on our planet for almost, by some estimates, 4 billion years. And during that time, we've seen species come and go, and we've seen organ systems and new ways of living come about, whole revolutions in life. And the question really is, how can we approach these things? And how can we think about what we've learned already in the first three lectures, and how can we apply that to these events? So where have we been? Well, in the first lecture, we looked at the invasion of land by fish, and we showed how we can discover fossils that tell us about how this great transition from water to land happened. And we showed how that's connected to our own bodies in many important ways, both in terms of the fossils as well as in the genes that control these things. In the second lecture, we used walking, the ability to locomote on four appendages as a means of looking at inventions and how they come about and how they can flourish over evolutionary time. And in the third one, we looked at what makes this all possible in some real sense, which is a skeleton, looking at the origin of bones and teeth. Now, what you'll notice in all these things, the word I've been using again and again and again is origins. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is how. What's the basis for the origin of key anatomical structures, of new ways of living, of the great revolutions in the history of life? And of course, there are many historical antecedents, many historical ancestors scientifically to how we approach this. But obviously, a big moment was the publishing of Darwin's Origin of Species, which came out in the first edition in 1859. And there were two general principles, both of which people had talked about before in different ways, in different kinds. The notion of common descent, that is, that there's a tree of life, that there's a history to the species that we see on the planet today, and that history can be traced deep in time. And the principle of natural selection, that is, there's a differential survival, differential reproduction can bring about the changes we see in evolution. Now, important for Darwin was the notion of gradual change, that this change is slow and always occurring, and this is how new species come about. So obviously, the Origin of Species had a major impact, certainly in 1859 and 1860, and Darwin fostered a lot of critics. And some of the most important critics to Darwin were his own fellow scientists. And one of them, in particular, really voiced major concerns, some of which we see in certain circles today. And that is one of his main critics was an anatomist, St. George Jackson Mivart. It's British, Mivart. And he was an anatomist. He trained with Huxley, Darwin's supporter and bulldog. And he was a great anatomist. He was somebody who worked on primates. He worked on carnivores and insectivores. In fact, some of his anatomical work stands the test of time over a century and a half later. But he criticized Darwin very importantly and very prominently. And what all this work suggested, what he implied, was that the early stages in the evolution of any structure, we'll call that the incipient structures, the earliest stages, that they're impossible. That really what you need is, in some of these cases, the initial stages of evolution for any particular structure are useless until all components are in place. That is, this notion of gradual change that Darwin proposed in The Origin of Species in 1859 sort of hit a wall, if you will, for Mivart, because it really doesn't explain complex structures and how they come about, where he couldn't envision how natural selection can act on the intermediate stages. And for instance, he would say, what is the use of half a wing? What is the use of half an eye? That sort of thing. And Darwin considered him a very, very important critic. Darwin did not ignore Mivart. In fact, Darwin, in the sixth edition of The Origin of Species, which came out in 1872, which we consider the sort of definitive edition of The Origin of Species, includes a response to his critics, notably Mivart. And what he said, I think, his response to Mivart resonates so strongly over 150 years later that it's really important for me to quote that today, because much of what we're going to talk about today is going to be derived from one little phrase in that volume. He said, all of Mr. Mivart's objections will be or have been considered in the present volume. That's the sixth edition of The Origin of Species. The one new point which appears to have struck many readers is that natural selection is incompetent to account for the incipient stages of useful structures. Just what I was telling you, right? And here is the dagger. This is what Darwin said that resonates years later. This subject is intimately connected with that of the gradation of the characters, often accompanied, and I bolded it, by a change in function. That much of evolution, according to Darwin, in this response to Mivart, much of this impossibility that Mivart brought about, can happen by the same structure acquiring new functions and then evolving in a different way. It's hard to overestimate just how important this little phrase was, because it explains much of what we think about anatomical evolution, whether it's comparative anatomy or fossils, much of what we think about genetics, much of what we think about biochemical evolution, same structure acquiring new functions. This is really important, and that's much of the talk I'm going to be giving today is based on that little phrase that really spawns so much. And to give you an example, I mean, we can do many, but I'm going to talk about several today, but one major example happens in our ears. Okay? If you look at our ears, as you know, we have three components. We have the outside piece you can see and the tube. We have the three little bones and muscles on the inside, which convert sound waves from the outside into the neural structure in the inner ear. And then we have the inner ear shown here all the way on the right, which is where much of the nervous transduction happens. What I want to focus on is these three little middle ear bones. Let's just take a different view of them. Here are those three middle ear bones. Okay, you could see them sort of right in the middle here, as you'd imagine. And they function in hearing now. That's what you're using to hear me with. And we can hear high-frequency sounds by the way those three little middle ear bones work. Now, you can imagine a criticism like Mivart would bring up would be something like, what use were ear bones in ancestors that didn't have ears? Right, were they invented out of whole cloth and fish that didn't have ears? What use were they when they were primitively large? You know, they couldn't have been always this small, that sort of thing. Well, the response is really seen in the fossil record and comparative anatomy and development and developmental genetics. Let me just show you. The fact is, the bones had originally different functions early on. One of them was a gill bone that got smaller and smaller. It functioned in respiration and feeding in fish. The other two were jaw bones, which functioned in feeding in reptiles and so forth, and they gradually got smaller. The key thing here is the old parts evolved in one way with one set or set of functions, and then there was a change in function where they functioned in hearing. And this change in function underlies much of this, what we see with the origin of novel structures. And indeed, this kind of evolution we see written in development as well. Because when we look at the development of these three little bones that were originally in jaws and gills, they actually can be traced to gill arch bones from what we showed in the first lecture. Here are the pharyngeal arches of a shark, shown in blue. Here's the pharyngeal arches, gill arches of a human, shown in blue. And in humans, they form two of these bones. In sharks, they form one of these bones. And that's originally a gill in sharks. What I'm saying here is that the change in function is really important. Now, this whole concept was reformulated in what came to be a very influential metaphor, and it's fitting I talk about this person in my last final lecture here at the college, Francois Jacob. Jacob obviously was famous for so many things, but he gave a very influential lecture at the University of California at Berkeley in the late 1970s. And he restated that lecture at the University of Washington a few years later, and both appeared in different papers. The Berkeley lecture appeared in a science paper, very influential, and the Washington lectures in a small volume, a small book. And he said something, I'm going to read what he said, because I think it's very elegant, and it's kind of what we're going to be looking at today, is that natural selection, this is from Jacob, natural selection has no analogy with any aspect of human behavior. However, if one wanted to play with a comparison, and again, he's making an important metaphor here, one would have to say that natural selection does not work as an engineer works. It doesn't design things from scratch. It works like a tinkerer who does not know exactly what he is going to produce, but uses whatever he finds around him, whether it is pieces of string, fragments of wood, or old cardboards. In short, it works like a tinkerer who uses everything at his disposal to produce some kind of workable object. And what Jacob is really talking about here is the importance of history. That if you look at the history, just like reframing Darwin to some extent, that evolution in producing new variation uses what exists in novel ways, using the old to make the new. So what I want to talk about today in this format, this background, really it gets to tinkering and innovation. How can we take Jacob's notion of tinkering, Darwin's notion of change in function, and really think about the origin of major innovations in the history, in the 4 billion year history of life? You're seeing 4 billion years wound as a corkscrew here, and through that time there's been so much change. How can we put this all together? So what we're going to do is we're going to look at how things can be repurposed and gain new functions in this form of tinkering that Jacob talked about. We're going to talk about how the great transitions, the great revolutions in life, like the shift from water to land, how they can be based on tinkering and how tinkering can fit into that. Finally, we're going to end with talking about how history can shape the future, how the past and history, the way evolution has happened, can affect the trends and how evolution can happen today and indeed even tomorrow. So let's talk a little bit more about tinkering, and essentially what it means is using the old to create the new. And there are many ways that this can happen. Indeed, this could be a whole course. Something can be redeployed in a new context. It can be co-opted for a new reaction. It can be repurposed. It can be duplicated and changed as a result of duplication. Two different parts can merge together to make something new. You can imagine many different ways that this tinkering system can work, and indeed evolution has found you and deployed all of them. Okay? What I want to do today is to talk about this co-option and redeployment piece, because we've already talked about it to some extent, and I want to take it a little further. Remember in the third lecture, we talked about how when we look at the exoskeleton of jawless fish, what they have on the outside is bone and scales, and that those scales have a histological structure that is similar to the tooth system. That is, you have a form of enamel or enameloid, a hard tissue. You have a tubular structure shown in green here, which in teeth is called dentine. It's true in this armor as well. And you have bone below it. And the central idea is that teeth, remember we talked about it in last week's lecture, and those of you who weren't there, it basically the central idea is that our teeth originally arose as sensory armored structures on the outside of the body of the most ancient fish. That is an example of repurposing, right? Armor being repurposed as teeth. And it's essentially this notion of outside in, that teeth originally arose on the outside of the body as armor, as sensory armor in particular, and that system that made teeth was redeployed to be inside the mouth as teeth, outside in. That's repurposing. That's evolution by tinkering. And the kind of the central idea is you have this tooth-like structure, whether it's a scale of a shark or a tooth in a human or something like that. We call that an odontode. But developmentally, it began in these small patches of thickened epidermis. And those small patches of thickened epidermis have cells underneath them called mesenchymal cells. They accumulate, and there's a series of genes that are turned on, this gene Wnt and these others, EDA and EDA receptor, that they're turned on to make these patches. The central point is you have a common process to make these patches, these dark patches, that ultimately undergo morphogenesis and differentiation to become an odontode. In one case, it's making this structure on the outside of the body and the epithelium on the outside of the body. In another one, following the system, and the epithelium in the inside of the mouth. So it's redeploying this recipe, if you will, to make odontodes. That's tinkering, right? That's kind of what Jacob, and to some extent Darwin, was talking about. But here's the main point, though. There is tinkering even at a grander scale. Because if you take this mode of development, you can follow it as the initial stage and see that it is modified to become lizard scales, feathers, hair, even a rich variety of skin organs. So when you look at this sort of basic tinkering that happened from the outside in, from teeth on the outside as armor to teeth on the inside of the mouth as chewing structures, the same developmental process with a package of genes interacting, cellular interactions that follow this general form of making these patches with thickened tissue and cell migration and so forth, that it can be, as a basis, can be tinkered with, if you will, and modified to make a variety of different skin organs. Okay, so what we're seeing is nature using the old to make the new. In this case, it's using an old process to make a diversity of new structures. Now, the key thing here, and I want to talk about this, is there's a deep genetic basis for these things as well. What I'm talking about here is the anatomy of development, right? How these cells get together. But there's also, when you look at it, there's a deep genetic basis. And I want to take a minute to talk about something that's how this co-option can have a true genetic basis. And I'm going to give you a different example, one that appeared recently in collaboration with Professor DeBoole and Matt Harris in Boston. What we're going to look at is how a paper that appeared about a month and a half ago that was led largely by Denis DeBoole's lab with some contribution of my lab as well as Matt Harris's lab. And it was really driven by the work of three fabulous postdocs, Orly Hinterman, Chase Bolt, and Brett Hawkins. And the idea here is that if we're looking now not to teeth, we're going to look at appendages. And we're going to look at co-option and tinkering, if you will, change in function in the evolution of appendages. Just take this primitive series here from primitive jawless fish on the left, a jawed fish in the middle, and a tetrapod, I'll use a human here, on the right. And I'm comparing creatures with one set of creatures which have no paired appendages. You see in this lamprey here, I can draw on a hagfish as well. What you see is just a median fin, but there are no paired fins or no paired limbs. When you look at fish like zebrafish or coelacanths or lungfish or what have you, they have paired appendages. They're those paired appendages, paired front, paired rear, those are fins. And then when you look at a human, like any tetrapod, we have paired appendages with digits. So no paired appendages, which are fins, and then paired appendages, i.e. fins, but with digits, fingers and toes and the bones that control them. So what I'm going to show you is a developmental process of co-option where a whole new set of structures came about that plays an important role in a great change in the history of life. So I'm going to try to distill a very complex story to a small number of slides. But essentially, it begins with this notion of Hox genes. And I'm talking about the Hox genes of a particular group, the Hox 13 paralog group, of which are active in our limbs are Hox A13 and D13. What you're seeing here is a mouse limb on the right, cleared and stained. And you're seeing on the left a mouse limb bud. Okay, this is a bud. It's before it's developed into the limb. And you can see it has this lovely little paddle where the digits will develop. And you can see where the digits will form and the little spaces, the interdigital spaces between where the digits will form. Shown in black here is where Hox D13, one of those genes I just talked about, is expressed, where it's active in the limb. And you can see it's active in the whole region that's going to become the finger area. Okay? Now, a series of very elegant experiments were done in the 90s and 1990s to show that when you knock out the genes of the Hox 13 group in the limb specifically, what you end up with is a limb without the digits. Okay, so here you have genes that are turned on in the region that's going to form the digits, and then when they're knocked out together, you form an appendage that's lacking that region of the appendage entirely. Okay, so the idea here is what's going on with this particular region here. Now, we know that these genes in mice are active in what's going to form the sort of the digital area of the limb bud. I just showed that to you, and there's knockout experiments that are part of that as well. But these genes also play a role in other parts of the body. This is where Darwin and Jacob come in, that these genes are involved in also the development of a number of structures, but importantly, the urogenital system. So here you see the kidneys of a male. Here's the kidneys of a female. And you can see as we go to the terminal end of the urogenital system, what you see is the urogenital sinus, and shown stained here is where Hox D13 is expressed in the urogenital system, at the terminal end of the urogenital system of a mouse. So this particular gene is turned on in a mouse during the formation of digits and during the formation of the terminal end of the urogenital system. Okay? Two functions, right? And let me add another layer into this as well from research that came out of Denis' lab about 15 years ago. That is, if you look at this pattern of expression of this gene, HOX D13 here, in that region that's going to become the digit. And this is the coding region of the genes here. If you look adjacent to it, an area that, extends several hundred kilobases, it's a big area, that there are a series of enhancers or regulatory elements that drive this expression. These elements are important for having this pattern of gene expression. So this region of the genome, this massive region of the genome, with this series of regulatory elements, enhancers in this case, are driving that activity. Okay, that's really important. This one region has all kinds of structures that enable it to play in this role, three-dimensional structures and others, and they function dynamically in that. But the key thing for our part right now is that this region plays a role in that expression. To the point where, if that region's function is abrogated, if it's knocked out in some way, okay, a number of ways that can happen, but in this case, when the function of this region is disrupted, what happens? You end up with a limbud with no HOXD expression. So the central take-home message of this particular slide, making the story short, is that this region is essential for that expression of the HOXD gene. Okay, and that was an important result from Zinni's lab, Dubul's lab, in elegant work in about 15 years ago. But here's the important point. When it's looked to see what happens when that region is gone in mice, they're lacking the urogenital expression as well. So I told you that normally that is expressed, that the HOX genes are expressed in the urogenital system as well as the limbs. But in this case, when this is knocked out, it's missing that as well. So the central point is, when this region is disrupted, you have complete loss of HOX D13 activity in the limb and a complete loss in the urogenital system. So dual function. Now, if we want to look at the history of tinkering, if we want to follow Jacob or Darwin, change in function, what about fish? What's going on in fish in this case, and how is that, and how can we think about how these dual functions were assembled over time? Well, okay, Denis' lab manufactured CRISPR mutants that lacked this region, so it's knocked out. And what you see here is just like the mouse, the fish is behaving like a mouse. What you see is a complete loss in the urogenital component. In this case, it's called the cloaca. Here's the wild-type fish right there. There's the embryo of the wild-type fish where my pointer is. Now let's zoom in on the wild-type here, and you can see the expression here in the cloaca, the urogenital area. And what's important is the comparison where that region is deleted. And where that region is deleted, you see you've lost expression entirely. Okay, so this region is really playing a role, a very important role, in driving expression in the urogenital system. What's happening in the fin? Now it's not behaving like a limb. What you see here is only partial loss and variable in the fin. Here is a wild-type fin. There's the fin, and these blue dots are where it's driving the expression of the HOX genes. In the deleted ones, I'm just showing you two flavors of them here, you have them knocked down to different degrees. So you have some, but not all. So the regulatory system in a fin is different than a fish. In a fish fin is different from a mouse limb in that in a mouse limb, all the enhancers are here in this region. In a fish, you have some but not all. In fact, most probably are in this region as well. Okay? So this leads to the evolutionary comparison. That is, if you look at this region, which we're calling 5-DOM here, which drives HOXD expression in limbs in your genital system, in an amniote like a mouse, it drives strong expression in the fin, distal fin, and in the distal limb, I should say, and in the urogenital, what will become the urogenital system in the cloaca region. But in a fish, in this rayfin fish, Actinopterygian, you have the cloacal function, but the fin function is seriously reduced. The question then becomes, if we want to understand the history of co-option and new functions, what we really need to do is look at jawless fish. Well, jawless fish provide a great test, like lampreys and hagfish. That is, if you look at them, they don't have paired appendages, so that's got to be a zero. It's not there. What's going on in the cloaca? Is the cloacal thing primitive or derived? Well, we could look at expression in lampreys, as well as other fish as well. And it turns out, universally in fish, and also present in lampreys, is the HOXD equivalents, the orthologs, are driving expression in the cloacal system. So what does all this mean? It really means here's Jacob and Darwin at the gene regulation level. That is, if you look at this map here, what you have is in jawless fish, they have the cloacal activity, but obviously they don't have the paired fin activity. So a genetic program originally functioned to pattern the cloaca in jawless fish. And then later in evolution, in the evolution of jawed vertebrates, particularly in evolution of limbed vertebrates with digits, it was co-opted, this region was available, to function in developing the digits and the appendages and so forth. So what you're seeing here is tinkering at the gene regulatory level. And it's happening at the regulatory level of an entire region. This region is accessible and available to drive the expression in the cloaca, and that's later used, tinkered with, to make digits. Very powerful. So what I want to do is to really see, Ben, we've talked about tinkering, we've talked about the genetic level, developmental level, but I really want to think about what does all this mean? What does all that genetic co-option and these other things mean for the great transitions in the history of life? All 4 billion years of creatures doing all new things and new ecologies and so forth. Well, let's talk about the transition from life in water and life to life on land, something recapitulating what we talked about in the second lecture. When you think about the transition from this very simple diagram, from life in water to life on land, numerous traits are needed for animals to be able to exist on land. They need to have arm and leg bones. They need to have necks. They need to have support for the hips, shoulder support, lungs. They need to have the ability to bite, to capture prey, excretion of nitrogenous wastes, sensation in air. I mean, it's a long list of stuff that need to change to go from fish to land-living animals. And indeed, if you just look at a simplistic version of this, it looks downright impossible. And you know, the argument sometimes you hear is features would need to spring about simultaneously for this thing to happen. What good is having a limb when a creature doesn't have lungs? What good is a creature having lungs if it doesn't to live on land if it doesn't have the sensory systems to enable acquisition of land? So many things would appear to have to happen at once. And indeed, Mivart made this kind of argument. But let's look at one system. Let's look at lungs very simply and then return to the main point. You look at lungs, you look at today, as you know, there are lungfish. There are lungfish alive today. There's genera in Australia, Africa, South America. They have lungs. They have lungs and gills. And what do? They go up when they need to breathe air and when the oxygen of the water depletes. They use their lungs, not their gills. And they'll go to the surface, take gulps of air, and then go to the bottom again. They have a dual system. And that system, which one they use, really depends on their activity levels and how much oxygen is in the water at that given time. And indeed, when you look at their lungs, whether you look at it anatomically, developmentally, or genetically, they are homologous or similar in an evolutionary sense to ours. Here's one from Protopterus. This is the African lungfish. You could see its lung here. These lungs tend to run the length of the body, by the way. But here you're looking at a cross-section of that, and you could see the lobes of this lung. You could see the various alveolar equivalents of the tissues in the lung. In fact, if you look biochemically at the surfactant proteins in the lungs, it's very similar, and on and on and on. These are homologs to our lungs. So just to go back to our main argument, if you look at a tree of life here, tetrapods, limbed animals are on the right, these land animals, if you will. Fish are on the left in this cladogram. Lungs originally arose, when we map their presence, in aquatic fish. They arose in fish adapting to aquatic ecosystems. Aquatic ecosystems that likely had very variable content of the water. And that was available when creatures went to live on land. That change existed well in advance of the invasion of land. The invention that was necessary for the invasion of land arose before the revolution itself. And that's the general theme at the genetic level, at the developmental level, at the morphological level. The biological innovations that are necessary for revolutions predate the revolution itself. They're used in a different context. They're tinkered with, as Jacob would say, during the revolution. And this is recapitulating a point we made in the second lecture, but just for now a new emphasis. Lungs, as I mentioned, arose in aquatic fish. Arms and legs with wrists and ankle joints arose in aquatic fish. That's the first lecture. Necks arose in aquatic fish. First lecture as well. Walking arose in aquatic fish. Second lecture. All this arose in aquatic fish. Indeed, a genetic program to form digits was already present in aquatic fish, patterning other structures. The tools necessary, the inventions necessary for the revolution predate the revolution. So you're basically seeing tinkering at a grand scale, enabling major changes in adaptation and evolution. So fish adapting to aquatic ecosystems already acquired the innovations useful for life on land. So we've talked about co-option and repurposing. We've looked at how features can evolve in one context with one set of functions, and then the big change is not a structural change necessarily, but it's a change in how that system works or how it's deployed. How it's worked, maybe it's a genetic system working in a new tissue. How it's deployed, maybe it's lungs working in water versus originally then to work on land. We've talked about how this tinkering can relate to major revolutions in the history of life. And if there's one take-home message I want to leave you with in that second part of the lecture, is that if you think, many people think, that lungs evolved as creatures evolved to walk on land, feathers arose as creatures evolved to fly, certain features arose as they did other things, those people are in good company, but they're wrong, and we've known that for over a century. That is, feathers arose before flight ever came about. Lungs arose before tetrapods, fish ever walked on land. That the inventions necessary for these revolutions happened earlier. Finally, what I want to talk about, and this is where I want to close today, is something that actually relates to the antecedents of my own scientific career and some stuff I worked on probably about 30 years ago, which is now increasingly relevant to me at least, is really how history shapes the courses of evolution. What we've been talking about so far is looking in the history of structures or the history of developmental programs or the history of genes. We see how life tinkered to produce new variation, using the old to make the new, successively, old to make the new at every level. So you have repurposed old stuff and changed, altered old stuff all the time. What does that mean for the process and the pathways that evolution can happen? Because evolution can happen in different ways in different groups. And in part, in a large part, that relates to their history. And we can show this and we can know this. And it actually shows the ways that organisms can evolve in response to natural selection has a historical signal. Has a historical signal on the kinds of tinkering that happened in the past. That's where I'm going with in this third and final section of today's talk. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at modern amphibians. We're going to look at frogs on the left, salamanders on the right. And these creatures are wonderful laboratories for evolution in so many ways. They're wonderful laboratories for evolution because they do many things. Their fossil record is actually not bad. And we can actually look at the patterns of morphological and variation within these groups. And here's, when we look at these patterns in certain ways, we see two fundamental ways that these creatures evolve. Let's take frogs. One way frogs typically evolve their feet and their hands is they lose digits. Digital reduction is a big trend in the evolution of frogs, their feet and their hands. And here's a generalized frog foot. There's a generalized frog foot with 5 digits. And you'll see, if you look at certain more derived feet of frogs, they tend to lose. They can lose a digit. They can reduce the number of phalanges. But typically, when frogs lose digits in phylogeny, they lose digits 1 and 2. Okay? They lose the ones on this side, 1 and 2. Okay? And we see this again and again in different species of frogs. It evolves independently, convergently, or in parallel, whatever word you want to use. They evolve in similar ways, differently. So when frogs lose digits, they lose digits 1 and 2, and they can do it independently, oftentimes multiple times. Salamanders, too, also evolve. And they evolve by oftentimes by reduction. And reduction by heterochrony is a big deal here. It was actually discovered by Dumouriez here in Paris in the 1800s. And their trend is they begin with 5 toes in the hind appendage, in the foot. And the dominant trend in the evolution of salamander feet is a reduction in the number of digits. You have 4-toed ones. You have 3-toed ones. I'm not showing. You have 3.5-toed ones. You have 2-toed ones. You have 1-toed one. But if you use a count of the phalanges, what they typically do exclusively, is they tend to lose digits 5 and 4 preferentially, and then 3. So the patterns of digital loss in these two taxa are in opposite directions. Frogs lose digits 1 and 2 independently multiple times in their evolution. Salamanders lose digits 4 and 5, actually also 3, independently in their evolution as well. Two different trends, opposite ways. Now what I want to talk about here is an approach to thinking about development I think that was pioneered by Para Alberg, the late Para Alberg, in the early 80s, and George Oster, a mathematical biologist in the early 80s as well. And Para and George really came up with a framework for thinking about the relationship between the role of genes in development. That was the idea is this, it's a very simple diagram, but it contains some important points for what we want here. Is that genes obviously make proteins which can control their own activity, but also define the properties of cells. That is, they can define how fast cells divide, where they die, how they die, how they stick together, cell adhesion, cell communication, all those. But cell properties, a set of cell properties, such that when those cell properties are defined, physics and chemistry during morphogenesis can define the geometry of a tissue, whether a tissue folds or whether a tissue is a flat sheet or forms a ball or what have you. But essentially, you have genes making proteins that can control their own activity, but also define a number of cell properties. And then together, those cell properties, sort of self-assembly and through self-assembly and the physics and chemistry deployed dynamically over time, you get a tissue geometry, which happens during development. And then those tissues can feed back on gene expression through induction. That is, when two tissues come in contact, sometimes genes can often be activated or repressed in certain ways. So what Para was pushing for was essentially a feedback loop during development, where genes are helping to identify, specifying cell properties together define tissue geometry, and then tissue geometry feeds back on the activity of genes. The key point here is that you can identify a series of cell properties which underlie morphological evolution. And what I'm going to be talking about is those cell properties here. I'm not going to be talking about genes today. I'm going to be actually talking about the properties here. And there's one property in particular that comes into play when we talk about the reduction of digits, and that is the number of cells in the limb, just the amount of tissue that's available to make an appendage, right? So Para did really some fundamental experiments in the early 80s, Journal of Experimental Embryology and Morphology Journal. Here's the limb bud of a frog or a salamander, just showing you that, and it's going to develop into a limb. And what he did was he treated the limb bud at critical stages of development with a mitotic inhibitor. And he did it with a couple different mitotic inhibitors, and they did it at multiple stages of development. And what they found is it affected the outcome of the development. That affected the number of toes that developed, whether they're frogs or salamanders. So I take a frog. The consistent result is sometimes they'd lose phalanges and they'd lose digits. And so you could see here is, this is the wild type frog, and you can see it has 5 digits, and treated ones typically, about half the cases, had about 4 digits. Likewise in salamanders, there are 5 digits in the wild type axolotl, and then 4 in treated ones. Now here's the important point. They lost digits as a result of the reduction in the number of cells, whether it's done with different mitotic inhibitors. But the key thing here is there was a species-specific, a taxon-specific response. That is, frogs in this experiment typically lost digits 1 and 2, as identified by the phalangeal formula. Salamanders typically lost digits 4 and 5. So there was a species-specific response to these experimental treatments. That is, the experimental treatments followed evolutionary history. That salamanders responded in one way, frogs responded in another. And there's some sort of internal process to the limb buds that determined these differential outcomes that are presumably reflected by history. Okay, so we have different trend in evolution. We have a different response to the manipulating the cell parameters, different frogs and salamanders, that corresponds to that. Why the difference in digit loss? Well, we can look at different things here. If you look at a developing salamander appendage, and I'm showing you axolotls right here, that is, salamanders, here's an early developing salamander limb with 2 digits, it doesn't have that paddle I showed you before. Remember I showed you that mouse that had that big beautiful paddle with the digits in it? Here you have a salamander, which looks like a bullet actually, you can see the cells inside. Digits 1 and 2 form first, and then digits 4 and 5 for last. So here's 1 and 2 forming later in development, and then 3 is coming in, then 4 and 5 will come in later. So the sequence of development in a salamander limb is 1 and 2 form first, and 3, 4, and 5 last. Frogs, I think you see where I'm going, do the entirely opposite thing. In frogs, 4 and 5 develop first, and then 3, 2, and 1 develop later. So 4 and 5 develop first, and 1 and 2 develop last. So what you have is a system where both in evolution as well as in experimental manipulation through manipulating simple cell parameters, what you get is a situation where the first digits to develop are the last to be lost, and the last to form are the first to be lost, like accounting, right? It's the first in, last lost, that sort of thing. So it's really the sequence of reduction experimentally and evolutionarily is following the evolutionary trends. So salamanders and frogs exhibit two different trends of digital evolution. We've talked about that. Simple manipulation of cell parameters mimics development and evolution. And the patterns of loss reflect differences in the timing of development. Now, this really begs the question, right? We're talking about tinkering. And when you think about tinkering, deploy Jacob's idea in evolutionary time, right? You have a history of tinkering. Using the old to make the new at one level leads you to more recent creatures, which are using the old to make the new, successive levels of tinkering. Why do you have different timing? Why do you have a difference in development? Because if it's the sequences of development that are driving these differences, what's going on? And here's the ticket. When you look at salamanders and compare them to every other tetrapod, every other creature with limbs, their digits development is pretty unique. Their digit development is this 1 and 2 first, 3, 4, and 5 later. That's unique among tetrapods. And you ask the question is why? Is the key thing is the development of limbs in salamanders is itself a form of a larval adaptation. And why am I saying that? Well, the more you look at salamander limb development, the limb functions as a fin early on. That bullet is actually being used to swim around by these salamanders. You watch an axolotl, just spend some time watching an axolotl swimming, a larva swimming around. They're paddling with this two-digited, bullet-shaped limb bud. And it has a little membrane between digits 1 and 2. It looks like a little fin, if you will. And then digit development, digit morphogenesis, actually happens while they're swimming. It's not happening in an ovo. They're swimming around while digit 3 comes in. Then a week goes by, digit 4 comes in. And then digit 5 comes in. So they're actually swimming with a developmental process happening. It is related, triggered in regeneration. But this is something that is happening while they're swimming around. So this thing is actually being used as a fin during that. And this digit 1 and 2 development, which is unique among tetrapods, is associated with that novel form of using an appendage while it's being, while pattern formation and morphogenesis is actually happening. And that differs dramatically from a frog. So what's the lesson of this part? In fact, what's the lesson of the whole thing? What's the lesson of all four lectures? History matters. Salamanders evolved a novel sequence of development that defined a new trend in digit loss that's different from frogs. Actually, it's different from other creatures with appendages. Evolutionary history affects future variation and evolution. So where have we been? We've really been talking about innovation in evolution. Whether it's by discovering fossils in the Arctic, by doing synchrotron scanning of tissues of 480 million year old fossils, whether it's designing robots that try to walk, looking at gene expression, gene regulation, and the comparative history of development. Together, these things help us understand history. Understanding organismal history is not the domain of a single discipline. It's the domain of a question. And that question demands data from different fields. So it demands a certain scientific athleticism to be able to pull these things together. And that's kind of what I tell my students is really you need to think multidisciplinary, particularly in this day and age. But together, what do these different things teach us? Obviously using the old to make the new, that history shapes the course of evolution. And importantly, and if there's one thing you take from these four lectures, and the one thing I want to leave you with is that we are deeply connected to the rest of life on our planet. That's a very powerful thing, but also a deeply beautiful thing. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.